Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in this morning for Mike Collins. For more than a century, newspapers set the agenda in cities and states across the U.S. More than just a home for the headlines, they were cultural institutions that defined and often challenged a community's soul. North Carolina's best-known newspaper, The News and Observer in Raleigh, has a surprising history and complicated legacy that encapsulates the contradictions, some of the best and worst of the state. Few people understand the power and struggles of newspapers better than Rob Christensen, who spent decades at North Carolina's Capital newspaper as chief political reporter. In his latest book, Southern News, Southern Politics, he recounts how the NNO shaped modern North Carolina in ways both profound and eyebrow-raising. Rob, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Eli.
So, as I just said, you spent decades at the NNO. Aside from it being your longtime journalistic home, why did you decide to make the paper the subject of your latest book?
So I had just finished another book on the Scott family, which is a sort of the closest thing there was to a dynasty, political dynasty in North Carolina, sort of like the Kennedys of Massachusetts and the Talmadges of Georgia and the Longs of Louisiana. And I really liked writing about a dynasty and multi-generational stories. And so the News Observer offered that because it was one family that owned the paper for over 100 years, and it told the story not only of the newspaper, but it also told the story about race in the South and the rise and fall of newspapers and both state and national politics, because they were a very politically involved family. So the story is not only this. What attracted me not only was it the story of a paper that I worked for 45 years, but it was really an intriguing story about how a newspaper could go from being very racist and to being declared by Jesse Helms, the late conservative senator, as selling out the South by 1953. So it was an interesting narrative to tell, and so it just drew me in.
So you start the book with kind of the start of the NNO's rise and its the beginning of its transformation from a little tiny paper to the influential paper it would become. And that story starts with a man named Josephus Daniels and his use of the paper as a cause for good and, frankly, awful causes. Take us back to the beginning, where you start the book with Josephus Daniels acquiring the News and Observer and his use of it for a white supremacist campaign that reshaped the state.
Yes. So Josephus Daniels was a young newspaper man from Wilson, North Carolina, and he was politically connected. He was a member of the Grover Cleveland administration and back in the 1880s. And he wanted an influential voice for the Democratic Party in the state capitol. Newspapers back then were very, very political. People talk about bias today, but they were openly biased, and they were backed by political parties, and there was no effort for any kind of balance. It was either a Democratic paper or a Republican paper. In North Carolina, most all of them were Democratic papers. And so he bought the paper when it was for sale and wanted to use it to advance the Democratic Party. Now, when he bought that paper, the state was undergoing a political revolution, in that the Republicans and the populists were coming into power. They had taken control of the legislature. They had thrown out the Democrats. They had a populist Republican U.S. senator, and this is the 1890s. And so he decided to use the paper as a vehicle for the Democrats to take back control of their congressional delegation, control of the legislature, control of the governorship, et cetera, et cetera. And so the paper was, in fact, a propaganda tool. And what he did was he used the several issues, but the main issue was race. The populace, the Republican Party back then was a party which included a lot of African American voters, and then some Republicans in the western part of the state, which were traditional Republicans, but it had a strong influence of African Americans. And so he used race to split the coalition of Republican slash populist called fusionist. And he used it by repeatedly citing racial issues, most of which were phony. So it was about every little incident involving a black and white person was blown up and portrayed in a very unflattering light for African Americans. He just made up stuff and attacked any kind of African American who was holding public office, and he fanned the racial flames using what we would now today call fake news. And this was not unusual at that time. This was the era, as you may recall, of yellow journalism. And that was when the two competing newspapers in New York were really started the Spanish-American War by writing about phony atrocities.
Remember the Maine days.
Remember the Maine, yeah. And so it was a newspaper war, really. Started with lots of fake news about events that never occurred and atrocities that never occurred. And so this was years before there was anything even considered a journalism school anywhere in America. There was very little ethics. Newspaper editors and publishers were often politicians running for governor, senator, whatever, sometimes for president. And so there was very little difference between politics and newspapering at that time. And Josephus Daniels used that both as a platform to get the Democrats back in control of the state, which they did over several elections. They tried it in 1896, and it didn't work so well. In 1898, they managed it through these white supremacy campaigns, which included violence and night riders, not the Klan, but something close to the Klan. They were called red shirts, and used it to regain control of the legislature. And then again, used it a third time in 1900 to elect a Democratic governor, Charles Brantley Aycock, and also to pass a literacy test and to restrict black voting, which would have an impact on several generations of African Americans in North Carolina. So he used that for very nefarious purposes.
And one of the things that I found really interesting reading this book about Josephus Daniels is that he's not a one-dimensional character. He's not simply a bad guy, to be simplistic about it. How do you make sense of all the contradictions he embodied? He was seen as a progressive, you know, this champion of working people, opponent of the rich and powerful, but also just a vicious, vicious racist.
So it is difficult for readers in the 21st century to get their minds around who Josephus Daniels was, because he was a racist without any question. And not only was he a racist, but he promoted racist policies and so forth. But he also was a liberal on almost every other issue. In fact, one conservative columnist described his type as a Jim Crow liberal, which is like, what? What is that? And so he was, for example, for labor rights. He was for women's rights. He was for improving an education system that was really terrible at the turn of the last century. He was against anti-Semitism. And on a whole range of issues, he was liberal. So how do you square those liberalism on those other issues with his racism? Well, you really have to get yourself in the mindset of the people of that era. And he wasn't alone. There were a lot of so-called Southern progressives that came into power in the late 1800s, early 1900s that were racist also. They believed, wrongly, of course, that for good government to return to good government, as they saw it, you needed to remove the African Americans who they thought this is only a generation out of slavery. They thought they were, liable to listen to corrupt politicians and so forth. And they thought that you could not have You could not improve government, improve the state, unless you removed African Americans. They were, of course, wrong about that, but that was not some strange, this was almost mainstream thinking back then. This was not some right-wing thinking. This was, so this kind of view was most newspapers had. This was a view that most academics had. This was a view that most newspaper people had. This was very entrenched mainstream views, this kind of racism, and it would go on for a very long time. We could forget how pervasive racism was. One example, I don't think I included it in the book, but there was right around this period, the Bronx Zoo in New York had put on exhibition a pygmy man. I'm not sure that the proper word they use today to describe these people, but a pygmy man on display in the gorilla portion of the zoo. And when a group of black ministers complained to the Bronx Zoo saying this is dehumanizing and outrageous, the New York Times wrote an editorial saying, what's the problem? We don't get it. So, you know, there was just a real blindness toward and pervasiveness of racial attitudes in that period, which doesn't in any way lessen Josephus Daniels' errors and sins, if you will. But it does. But you do have to put it in some sort of context. It was a extremely racist era.
And that is, as you said, hard for us to kind of comprehend in our modern thinking. But one of the surprising aspects of the book, too, was also how familiar a lot of the political fights that were occurring at this time in North Carolina sounded. They were fighting about school funding, about voting rights, about building roads and transportation and who would pay for them. They were fighting about workers' rights and wages. And in a lot of ways, I was reading this book thinking, well, you know, what's old is new again. They were having political fights that were largely understandable, except for this aspect that you mentioned, that the newspaper publisher, in this case of the News and Observer, but widespread at that time, was so directly involved. How did we start to move away from this idea that newspapers are partisan organs, that publishers are political operatives, that it's perfectly okay, to this more professionalized, modern, neutral, nonpartisan voice that we expect from the media and expected throughout the later half of the 20th century?
Well, to get to your earlier point, one of my favorite quotes is from former President Harry Truman, who was not very well educated, but he loved reading history. And he liked to say, the only thing new in the world is the history you don't know. So, and I kind of always kind of like that. So it was a gradual transformation of the newspaper business from purely partisan to try to be independent. In part, things like the 1920s, Walter Lippmann, who was probably the most famous political columnist of that era, started writing about newspapers really need to try to be fact-based and not just partisan. And so there was a whole movement. There was beginning of journalism schools to try to teach young journalists, upcoming journalists, to want to try to be factual. And then also it was it was good business to do this. So,
and I'm going to have to stop you right there for a quick break. When we come back, we will talk about the transformation of the News and Observer and other newspapers into the modern era. We've got Rob Christensen, an author of Southern News, Southern Politics, on Charlotte Talks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in this morning for Mike Collins. I'm joined by Rob Christensen, whose nearly half-century career at the News and Observer in Raleigh led him to his latest book subject, The Paper and Its Role in North Carolina. We're talking now about the transition to the more modern era and how the paper moved from a provincial and partisan publication to a modern scrappy paper that really punched above its weight. So before we talk about the changing journalistic landscape of the time, let's talk about the second generation of the Daniels family. After Josephus Daniels, this really colorful owner and publisher who brought the paper to prominence, it eventually passed, fitfully, I would say, to his son, Jonathan Daniels, the second generation. Who was he? How was he similar to, and how was he different from his father? And how did that stamp play out on the paper?
So Jonathan Daniels was one of three sons, I guess it is, of Josephus, and he was the one who was most interested in newspapers. One son, Frank Daniels, became the head of the business side. Jonathan became the editor, and he was quite different from his father. His father grew up in eastern North Carolina, probably the most conservative part of the state, during the Reconstruction, and Jonathan was born in 1900, and he grew up in Raleigh and also Washington, D.C., where his father was Secretary of the Navy. And he brought some very big changes to the paper. Most interestingly was on race. And so he wanted to make the paper not pro-civil rights. I think that would be a mischaracterization of what he did. But he tried to bring some sense of fairness to African Americans. And you have to remember that in that period of time, when we're talking about the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s, Black people had no voice, none, in the judicial system. All the juries were white, all the judges were white, all the district attorneys were white. There were something like two Black police officers in the entire state. And so if you were a Black person, you were facing a white-only society that may or may not have had your interest in justice at heart. And so he used his newspaper, the News Observer, as one of the few tools to point out injustices. So whether they were lynchings or whether there were, you know, chain gangs where somebody was shot while trying to escape, so-called. A lot of those people were shot were not really trying to escape. They were really legal murders. To police beatings, to Black people not being admitted in an emergency situation to white hospitals, but having to travel great distances to the nearest Black hospital. In Charlotte, for example, there was a case where two inmates, two teenage boys who were in for fairly minor offenses in the Mecklenburg County Jail, were chained to the railings or the guard bars or whatever of their cell. And it left in the cold so bad that their feet and it was so cold during the day that their feet turned gangrene. They had to be amputated, and no one was ever punished for that offense. And you know, the News Observer was one of the few papers that raised that issue and talked about the inhumanity of it. Another instance where the paper jumped in with its editorial power, firepower, was there were a number of African-American inmates that died in one of those transportable prison cars, essentially, that they would move for road gangs, for road work. And they put them in the road, and it caught fire, and a number of inmates died helplessly. And these sorts of things the paper would bring up. And even, it would also talk about the inequality between how much was spent on in the segregated school system on Black schools and how much was spent on white schools. And so the paper became a real voice against racial injustice. Now, we shouldn't get too carried away, because if you're looking at today, by today's viewpoint, it didn't go nearly far enough. It didn't call for the end of segregation. It did not support black jurors. There's a lot of things that it did not do. So Jonathan Daniels felt like his paper, although it was in Raleigh, it circulated in eastern North Carolina, which is the part of the state that's most like the Deep South and had the largest black population. And he felt he could only go so far with his readership in terms of pushing for, so he pushed for against injustices, but he didn't really push to change the system of segregation.
Yeah, you write that Martin Luther King Jr.'s letter from a Birmingham jail kind of describes that white moderate person who values order above change and justice, and that kind of being aimed at people like Jonathan Daniels.
Yeah, exactly. And so he was kind of behind, he was ahead of his time for a couple decades in terms of Southern major newspapers, but he was not in the vanguard of the civil rights movement. He wasn't opposing it as such, but he was not, he was certainly not a advocate for it. And he was often was voicing caution. So he was some of the people who Martin Luther King Jr. Talked about as being not being particularly helpful as the major push came to change the laws of segregation.
So around this time, after World War II, newspapers started really modernizing and entering what I think a lot of people think of as the Golden Age that really took off in the late 60s, and then Watergate, post-Watergate, real high points. We like to think about, as journalists, all the great journalism that happened during this time and the crusading papers, but it was really a gusher of money from car dealerships and department stores and the market dynamics of that time that allowed this to rise. So how did the News and Observer and papers like it benefit from the media market of that time? And how did that business transformation help power this journalistic transformation?
So, Eli, you're correct, of course, particularly during the post-World War II era. I mean, that was a boom era in America, and it saw really the creation in a lot of ways of the middle class as we came to know it, and there was a lot of affluence, and newspapers began making money hand over fist. They were great investments. They were making really large profit margins, mainly because they were the main source for advertising for, as you say, car dealerships and department stores like Hudson Belk and or like, you know, Belk's. This is where the best way they could reach their customers through their advertising was through newspapers. So newspapers were fat and thick and happy and earning lots and lots of money and making their owners rich and their stockholders rich. And it was because the society was becoming more affluent and people were buying, you know, cars and washing machines and you name it.
So you don't make a lot of appearances in your book, Southern News, Southern Politics, even though you were there for much of this time with your 45-year career there. But one area when you do use the first person is when talking about Jesse Helms and some of the interactions that he had with the press and with you at a rally, I think you describe, being called out by him. Tell me about the relationship between Helms and the News and Observer and this sort of, in some ways, it almost read to me as a symbiosis that he developed with the News.
So, I did try to keep myself out of the book because it's not a memoir, it's a history, and I wanted to approach it as a historian as opposed to an ex-journalist. So Jesse Helms, actually, who he's from, of course, Monroe, not too far from Charlotte, but he really made his name in Raleigh and as a TV editorialist, and he was really hired to be one of the first TV editorialists in the country by by this wealthy local businessman, A.J. Fletcher. And he was put on the air to be the conservative countervoice to the News Observer back in around 1960, I guess it was. And so he was against integration, against Martin Luther King, but he was really against the News Observer, and he hated the News Observer, even though he got a start. He started there as a reporter and editor for the News Observer, but then later went into radio and TV and became the conservative critic of it. And so he would attack the paper all the time. And the paper was very much opposed to Jesse Helms. Helms was not the kind of politician that the News Observer liked or appreciated. They didn't like his philosophy, and they didn't like his what they called his demagoguery, and so covering Helms was always exciting. You mentioned a couple things. I mean, I once was at one rally, I guess back in 1990, in Goldsboro, in a big tobacco warehouse. Tobacco warehouses back then were the largest auditoriums that were existing in a lot of these small Eastern North Carolina towns. And, you know, he had about 1,000 people there. Helms was on a roll, talking about how the liberal news media was ruining America. Does this sound familiar, by the way? And he was, you know, it was a laundry list of A, B, C, D, and E. And he finished by pointing right at me and says, as represented by Rob Christensen, who's sitting right there. And I had with me in tow that day a writer from the New Yorker magazine, and he sort of jumped up in his chair and looked around. And he said, "You know," he said, "that'd be scary if this crowd wasn't so damn old." So they once threw me out of the state Republican Helms people did threw me out of the state Republican convention back in 1984. They passed a resolution, whereas News Observer's never given Jesse Helms an even break. They threw me out. And I was being let out. People were yelling and screaming obscenities at me and standing in their chairs and shouting their fists, waving their fists at me. And I was being let out. The presiding officer of the convention, a fundamentalist minister from Elizabeth City, Barry Picardi, says, "The cancer has been surgically removed," as I was being let out. So the next time I saw Barry, at a next Republican event, I went up to him. I said, "Barry," he says, "I got some bad news for you, buddy." He says, "The cancer is back." So we had ups and downs with Helms, to say the least. He really ran for political office, running against the liberal news media and liberal institutions, in a lot of ways that, of course, are familiar today with Donald Trump. So he and Trump. They weren't similar in personalities in any way. Helms was a very square guy and married to the same woman all his life and everything, but was a churchgoer. But they had some of the same populist demagogic appeal, and they used the news media as their political whipping boy.
Yeah, I thought in reading that it was almost like a microcosm of the relationship that would develop between Trump and the national media decades later, reading about what happened in these Eastern North Carolina towns back in the 80s and 90s and your experience. I was like, wow, that sounds like a little preview of what we would come to see across the country.
Yeah. So I can remember going to a Trump rally, but before I retired and down in Fayetteville, and he was going after the news media, and I was like, it didn't take me back at all. I sort of like, I've seen this act before, you know, with Jesse Helms, and so it was all very, very familiar to me, and it was even preceded Jesse Helms. So one of the best journalists News Observer had was Gene Roberts, who later went on to become editor of the Philadelphia Inquirer and then managing editor of the New York Times, but he was a reporter for us for a while and an editor. And he would recall the 1960 campaign, where you had another liberal conservative split between Terry Sanford and I. Beverly Lake Sr., who was a big segregationist. And him being warned, this is down in Robeson County, I guess Lumberton, and him being warned covering a rally, a lake rally down there, that He needed to leave early because the crowd was going to come after him, and so he sneaks out right before Lake begins going after the News and Observer, and the editor who tipped him off was the local editor of the Robesonian paper there in Lumberton, and he hides him in the storefront newspaper office and turns off all the lights as his crowd comes roaring down the street with bricks and sticks and stuff. And then he calls the local sheriff, and gets him to escort the reporter out of the county, because they figured it would not look very good for Robeson County to have a News Observer reporter killed covering a political rally down there. So this goes back to at least 1960, and of course, and again, what really was at issue was race, and because I. Beverly Lake Sr. was one of the last openly segregationist gubernatorial candidates we had, and the News Observer was seen as on the other side of that issue. So that has led to a lot of very confrontational type situations between the politicians and the newspaper reporters.
Yeah, the more you know about history, the less is surprising. So at this point, the News and Observer eventually transitioned to its third generation of family leadership, preceding a sale in the fourth, which we'll talk about after this upcoming break. But if you could just quickly run through what were some of the really big successes that the News and Observer had in this era in the 70s, 80s?
So the paper had a very strong watchdog component to it, and so it, for example, and not all was just the politicians. Help put two labor leaders in prison, for example, for their misuse of money. It stories were led to the essentially the downfall of Jim Valvano as coach of NC State. It was it the it uncovered the scandals, for example, at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, especially their football, but also their basketball programs, about fake classes and that sort of thing. And that led to the retirement of a chan or the pushing out of a chancellor and
And that's
athletic director.
Rob Christensen, author of Southern News, Southern Politics. When we return, more on Charlotte Talks about the rise and fall of the News and Observer in Raleigh.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and Habitat Charlotte Region. Since 1983, Habitat Charlotte Region has partnered with more than 5,000 families through financial education, homeownership, and critical home repair. More information at habitatcharlotteregion.org.
It's Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo in This Morning for Mike Collins. My guest today is Rob Christensen, whose new book traces the rise and fall and enduring influence of the News and Observer of Raleigh, which was also his journalistic home for decades. So by the 1990s, the newspaper industry looked absolutely golden. Profit margins of 25, 35, 40% or more were routine. Papers were being valued at hundreds of millions of dollars, even mid-sized regional publications, and they pretty much just printed money for their owners. But the News and Observer's final generation of the Daniels family local ownership, some members of it saw storm clouds gathering. So tell me about the last generation and the ominous signs that some of them saw, I believe Frank Daniels III, when others didn't.
So that's right. Heading the business part of the paper were the three Frank Daniels. The one was Frank Daniels Sr. was the son of Josephus. Frank Daniels Jr. Became publisher after him, and then Frank III, who was a baby boomer, came in, and he was the final one. And he became editor of the paper, not just the business part of it. He replaced Claude Sitton, who was a very famous editor of the paper. And so Frank III came in from with a business and from a business point of view, as opposed to rising up through the newsroom. And he also had a real interest in high tech. And so he had he understood early on, for example, that the newspapers needed to really ramp up their digital operation. And so he was one of the first papers, News Observer was one of the first papers in the country to really begin moving toward digital news. But he also saw that newspapers were going to be in financial trouble. He saw what a lot of other newspaper executives did not see. And eventually, in 1990, and he the first thing he did was, the first several years as the editor, was he put a lot of money into the paper. And so we were now sending people overseas to cover stories, that sort of thing, which had News Observer as a regional newspaper had not done before. And he really beefed up our staff and our coverage. And so it was, and it led to a winning of a Pulitzer Prize for some of the problems in the hog industry in Eastern North Carolina. But anyway, he saw the problems. He saw before all these social media products came out, and before there was this really incredible change to the digital world, he began seeing what was going on. And he began pushing the ownership of the paper to sell, which it did in 1996 to McClatchy, which was a California-based chain, which eventually also bought the Charlotte Observer. And he got top dollar. The family sold the paper for something like $360 million, and that was more than what Jeff Bezos paid for the Washington Post back in whatever it was, 2013 or whatever it was. So they got
Plus, you
more
adjust for
currency.
inflation, and it's even more than that. I mean, yeah, you're talking like 3 times the price of the Washington Post, which is sounds wild.
So it was so, and of course, the Washington Post was a much bigger, more powerful, more important paper. And so timing is everything. They got out just before the industry began collapsing, and the family did very, very well. And then things went pretty well under McClatchy for the first number of years, because McClatchy had a reputation as being a quality chain, and they put more money into the paper, and the paper actually prospered, did lots of work over the first few years, until A, the industry began collapsing, and B, the McClatchy made some really bad business decisions, which including buying out Knight Ridder, which was a much larger chain, which is a chain that would be very familiar to Charlotte listeners because they own a Charlotte Observer. And it was a small fish eating a lot or swallowing a much larger fish in Knight Ridder. And it came just as the industry began collapsing. So it was the worst possible timing.
Yep,
And
they paid a record price at the top of the market just before the bottom fell out, which,
it was a
yeah.
disaster for McClatchy. Now, the industry was collapsing anyway, and so even without that tremendous error, bad times were ahead. But that just made it so much worse.
So one thing that I've wrestled with personally, my newspaper career started in 2005, kind of right at the top of the market, is how much did newspapers like the NNO, like the Charlotte Observer, and chains like McClatchy and Knight Ridder, how much were they willfully blind and, maybe made mistakes versus how much would they have gotten run over anyway? Because no matter what they did, Google, Facebook, the companies that ate the world when it comes to digital advertising, were going to rise and were going to take that. Those fat print margins, no matter what. Could they have stepped out of the way of the bus?
So that's an interesting question, Eli, and I don't think there's a simple answer to that question. So I think that there were huge trends that were happening here, which would have rolled over the newspaper, the print industry, no matter what. So no matter what they did. Now, could they have been? Could newspapers have been smarter about it? They by and large did not see it coming. Now, the News Observer was one that did, and they got crushed anyway. Because early on it got very much into digital side of things, but it didn't follow up as it should have. So there were all kinds of errors. One is newspapers should have been to a larger degree diversifying and getting into other businesses, right? Like TV or whatever. It was a huge mistake by McClatchy they did not put up a firewall. In other words, they did not charge for when they went digital. And so the theory was that if the newspaper was free online, that you could draw in more readers and therefore more advertisers. But that theory turned out to be wrong. And in fact, digital advertising has never even come close to the advertising bringing the revenue that advertising for the print edition has.
Right, it's something like a 1-to-10 ratio. It's just not in the same ballpark.
No, and so the newspapers that put up firewalls, that's a ter industry term meaning you had to actually pay a subscription price to see it, to read it online, did much better. And a lot of newspapers, including News Observer and the Charlotte Observer, because it was a McClatchy, it was their parent company policy, made a mistake in not putting up not charging for their digital content. They eventually did, but by that time, the house had burned down.
So, obviously, you and I, as newspaper alumni and journalists, are a little biased here. We tend to think that these institutions and newspapers were big positive forces, but a lot of people were not sad to see the demise of traditional news. The Raleigh News and Observer was, I think, the noise and nuisance disturber. We used to get calls when I was at the Charlotte Observer from one gentleman who would always leave messages overnight calling us the perverted disturber, which was a good nickname. What's your case for trying to convince people that we've lost something valuable, that as much as they might have not liked the paper sometimes, as much as people think it's biased, think it's scolding, think it's boring, whatever it is, that it's still the loss of something valuable that we are poorer without.
So, as you point out, Eli, I have a I'm biased because I spent my career in newspapers, but there's so many things that the newspaper brings to a community. So it's not only does it a good newspaper will provide in-depth news that's factual, that people of various across the spectrum can get their information, and that's been a problem today because everybody has their own facts, separate facts, but it was a shared space for facts, and it had a real watchdog element. I mean, it was not only put politicians in jail but it also labor leaders, and it discovered problems in the colleges and universities. So various parts of society were being watched. And then even just things like, today in lots of places, there's no reporter sitting in on town council meetings or school board meetings or county commissioner meetings or planning commission meetings. And so there's nobody watching the politicians now. And so, most people in political life are honest, but there's always the human element, and if nobody's watching, then you never know what they can get away with. Plus, there were things like, music critics. So people who go to a concert could read about the next day about what the critic, you could agree with the critic or not agree with the critic, about what they thought about this rock concert or this symphony or the ballet. And then there were, restaurant critics. So you could read that and you didn't have to agree with it, but it could give you some sense of whether the critics thought that a new restaurant was worth trying out. And just general columnists. So you could get their take on the latest news or what's going on. So it was a sense, it was this, and there was this letters to the editor and so forth. It was essentially gave a voice to a community.
Yeah,
and
I happen to believe that local communities were better off when we had local columnists and stuff providing things that opinions we could all react to together versus, you know, everyone's crazy uncle posting something on Facebook separately that we're seeing. And I feel like that social media doesn't fulfill for me that same element of a shared reaction space.
Yeah. So we, as they say in the legislature, we in agreement.
So what do you see as the future of these local institutions like the News and Observer, but also like the Charlotte Observer, these metro dailies that have been hollowed out but are still doing some good work and have journalists there who still deeply care and have a lot of brand equity?
So that's a very interesting question, and I don't think we know the answer to it. Certainly, we can see what's going on around the country. And so the weaker newspapers are failing. The other regional newspapers are, you know, are shells of what they used to be, but they're still holding on. I think we're going to see, as we have continue to see, newspapers moving more to online as opposed to, I guess it's still pretty expensive to have a print paper delivered in your driveway every morning. So I think, I don't know how many more years you're going to be able to get that. I mean, I think some newspapers will thrive, especially newspapers where people are willing to pay a lot of money for. So like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal would be examples of that. So I think we'll continue to have some thriving national newspapers. But the question is whether the more regional newspapers like the News Observer and the Shaw Observer will continue to exist. I hope that they do. There's no guarantees. They are a shadow of what they once were.
So timing is everything. As you said earlier, you retired in 2018, got to ride a lot of the golden age wave there, and unfortunately see a lot of the quick collapse and decline of the industry. Do you miss it? Newspapering?
So not really. I mean, I still read a couple of newspapers a day, and I still follow politics pretty closely. But when I got out of the business, I really got out of it, and I had begun essentially a second career writing history books for the University of North Carolina Press, and so this is my third book, and I'm working on a fourth. And so I just changed from journalism to popular history, I guess you would call it. But, you know, the instinct's still in you. You know, when I hear a fire truck, you know, go down the street, my instinct is to get in my car and see where that fire truck's going. So, because there's an old newspaper man that's burned into my psyche.
So we've got a little bit more than a minute left here. How would you sum up the legacy of the Daniels family and their ownership of the Raleigh News and Observer?
So, you know, there have been good papers and there have been bad papers, and News Observer has been both. It's been both. It had a terrible legacy of racism that really damaged the ability of African Americans to live in dignity. And it also has a pretty good legacy of being a voice for racial injustice, for pushing for an improved society, for improved education, and it was had an important watchdog element. You know, politicians always had in the state capitol always had to nervously look over their shoulder to see whether the News Observer was watching, which is not a bad thing, by the way. So it's a very mixed legacy. I think I think it's been helpful to this, helping shape the state, and it helped gave political cover to a lot of politicians.
That's Rob Christensen, longtime political journalist at the News and Observer in Raleigh, and author of the book Southern News, Southern Politics, which is out now wherever you get books. Rob, thank you for the hour.
I enjoyed it.
This is Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE. I'm Eli Portillo, in for Mike Collins today. See you tomorrow.
Charlotte Talks is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah D'Elia. Our producer is Chris Jones. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or to subscribe to the Charlotte Talks podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.